Good afternoon. My name is Dick Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. Everybody, but for the grace of God and the actions of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since September the 15th, 1965, and I'm very grateful for that this afternoon. I sincerely hope that you all were in here and heard Murray Pearl talk a little earlier, you alcoholics, and kind of gives you an example of what you're going to get if you start drinking again. Just thinking of living with her is enough to keep me sober for a long goddamn time, I'll tell you. But I was glad that I was here and heard what you had to say again. I've heard Mary Pearl speak many times and always enjoyed her and always enjoyed what she had to say. And obviously she did too, and she heard what she needed to hear because goddamn it, she didn't come back. I'm not suggesting that she has any ego or something, but she was always glancing up at these mirrors here to see the reflection of herself. You thought she was looking heavenward, didn't you? Something happened to me when I drank that didn't happen to other people around me when they drank. And what happened to me is that I felt like they looked. And that's the whole story. That's it right there. The people around me seemed to look like they had it together. They had it together. They knew what they were doing. They knew where they were coming from. They knew where they were going. When I was a young guy in high school, they knew what they were going to be when they grew up. They were going to be doctors or lawyers or thieves or whatever the heck well it is they knew that they were going to be. But they all knew what they were going to be. And that's a natural question. Well, you're going to college. Well, what are you going to study? Well, what are you going to be and what are you going to do? And I always just kind of ducked away from those conversations because I never did know what I was going to be when I grew up. And if I'd have known what I know now, I could have said, well, I'm going to be an alcoholic. But I didn't know that. And that's the only positive thing that I could have told them, because I can tell you right now, I've done a lot of things since I've been sober. I worked in broadcasting for 27 years. I had a good career in broadcasting. And always in the business end, never behind the mic, so to speak. But I always enjoyed that, and I made a good living at it. But I never intended to do that. I took a part-time job at a radio station while I was going to college, and I didn't have anything better to do, and they offered me a better job. And so I didn't have anything better to do, so I took it, and they offered me a better job. And I never did know what I was going to do when I grew up. And even to this day today, I don't know. And I don't really care. I don't know whether I'll ever grow up or not. Maybe that's what the problem is. But I've never wanted to discuss things like maturity among my peers. And I still don't like it today. I don't like these people who come in and say, well, you know, the problem with an alcoholic is that they're immature. And I don't believe that. I think Chuck Chamberlain had the right idea. We're just sensitive. We're just sensitive people. It's not immaturity. It's just sensitivity. We're overly sensitive about things. And I would prefer to think that, too. I know when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a lot of conversation going on around that said that alcoholics seem to be overachievers. They seem to be more capable than non-alcoholics. And the only people that were saying that were the alcoholics. But I listened to it, and I thought it was a hell of a good idea to listen to those voices, because those voices in Alcoholics Anonymous made me feel good and made me feel better about myself. It's not that I felt bad about myself. I just didn't think about myself except all the time, and I was terribly confused, which kind of reminds me. I don't know whether any of these tapes are going to be something that I'm going to want to take home this weekend. I imagine they would. But, Bob, I'd like a tape of Herb's remarks before the meeting, please. Before the other meetings. He didn't make them before my meeting. But Well, that's what happens when you get run off the program by an Al-Anon, I guess. But I certainly would like to have a collection of Herb's remarks beforehand. It's been very exciting. But I always enjoyed Alcoholics Anonymous from the first moment I ever went to AA. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous just out of a fluke, by the way. It wasn't just something I decided that I would do. It wasn't somebody that threw me in a treatment center and just they guided me to Alcoholics Anonymous, or they said you ought to go there because you're crazy and you'll get better. Nothing like that happened to me. What happened to me is as I was growing up, when I remember I took my first drink, I was 14 years old, and I drank a can of Canadian Ace Ale. And it was the first full drink that I'd ever had. And I'd been out on a walk on a cool fall day with a buddy of mine, a chum, and we'd found this six-pack hidden under a log, really, or by a log. And we found that, and I asked him if he wanted a can, and he said yes, and I took the church key and opened that and gave him one, and I took one. Ed sipped on his, and I drank mine, and we sat there and we talked, and all of a sudden, the thing that happened to me was just, Ed was a friend of mine, and I had known him for many years, and couple of years at that point, and he's still a friend of mine yet today. He's probably the only non-alcoholic friend that I have from my childhood or from early on or during my drinking days even. And I don't see him often, but our friendship is firm, and we always have a good time with each other when we get together. But As I said, I drank my can, and I turned around to Ed and asked him if he wanted another can. And he said, no, I haven't finished the one I have yet. And he said, I don't want to do that. He says, I'll get drunk. Now, Ed was a very bright guy, and he was very, very well-mannered, and he was nice-looking, and he was athletic, and he could sing, and, you know, he could do all kinds of things that I couldn't do, or that I didn't think that I could do, or that I was afraid to attempt, because if I attempted it, and even in learning, I would look foolish. And I didn't want to look foolish in front of anybody else, because I was already knew what a big fool I was then. And so I didn't want to look foolish. And so I was not tempted to try new things or to do different things, because I didn't want to look foolish, because I felt foolish on the inside. And I was afraid to do those things. But when I took a drink, I wasn't afraid to do anything. I wasn't afraid to attempt anything. And I attempted a lot of things when I was drinking that I probably shouldn't have, and some that I'm glad that I did. And as an end result, I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous because I had to drink to do things. I had to drink to get somewhere. I had to drink to do something. I had to drink to be somebody. And because I didn't like who and what I was. I was, like many people, my father was a practicing alcoholic, and he died as a result of a drunken fall down the basement steps when he was 57 years old, and he'd been nominated for a federal judgeship, so he was doing pretty well for himself even at that. But my mother had years before that tried to exact a promise from me that I would never drink. The earliest memory I ever have is of my father coming home drunk and her raising hell and trying to get him to go to bed and him raising hell with her and the name calling and all the noise and the yelling and the screaming. That's the earliest memory I have. And I know that today, the one thing that I always wanted to do I went into the service when I was about 19. The whole thing I wanted to thought about the whole time I was in the service, well, when I come home, I'll be old enough to drink with my father, and I'll be able to sit down and I'll be able to talk to him. I didn't want to sit down and talk to my mother. She was the disciplinarian in the family, and I didn't want to talk to her, but I wanted to talk to him. Because I loved him, and I really cared for him, and I didn't love my mother, and I didn't care for my mother, and I didn't love her or care for her at that time purely and simply because she was the disciplinarian, and she was never someone I could depend upon. She seemed to react differently at different times, and nothing seemed to change. And I really just never cared for her for that reason. And so I had a bit of difficulty with that when I was growing up, trying to think, while I was drinking, trying to think, well, one should respect and love their mother, and one should care. And I didn't, and I didn't like that, and I didn't like the feelings that that brought about. And as it ended up, after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I took care of that, and I'll talk about that a little later. But I drank as much as I could because I couldn't stand being the person I was. It's kind of funny when I was drinking because the people who criticized me were the ones that that really I respected. I respected the people who criticized me and criticized my drinking, and I respected them out of fear because they knew what I was. And those people who liked me and those people who gave me pats on the back, I didn't have any respect at all, because if they knew what I was, they wouldn't treat me that way and they wouldn't act that way to me. They would have discarded me a long time ago. So here I was, fearful of one group of people on one side and contemptuous of another group on the other side, and that left me kind of friendless, just simply kind of friendless and kind of alone. And that I noticed that early on, and that was the beginning of what I know now to be alcoholic loneliness. And when that alcoholic loneliness set in, and it set in at an early age for me, I couldn't do anything about it. It just was there. And it was my constant companion. And it was with me then. I'm very fortunate, since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, that it visits me occasionally, and it visited me a lot years ago. And it occasionally visits me today, but it doesn't visit me very long, and it isn't as severe. And I can just let it pass by, and I can say, oh, well, it'll be okay. And I can get up and do something and change and make a phone call, go to a meeting. I can do any numbers of things and to get myself out of that, so I don't feel that way. But it isn't really. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, it isn't really that you're going to come in here and you're going to get over all of your feelings of emotion and your feelings of self-pity and anguish and pain and anxiety and frustration and depression, because they're going to come and visit you. But they don't visit for long, and you don't have to drink about them. That's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous is I can have the same feelings that I used to have when I was drinking, and now I don't have to drink. That is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why we say AA works, because it does work. It has taken the place of something else. The chemical alcohol was always my solution, because it always made those feelings go away, because I could be anxious or fearful or frustrated or confused like I am now. I could have all of those feelings. I could have all those feelings, and I could take a drink, and I didn't give a damn. I just didn't care. And I didn't care what you thought. I didn't care what anybody thought. I just didn't care. It just didn't make any difference to me. Now I can do what I want to do, because once I took a drink, something happened to me. I changed. The world changed. The whole thing, the whole picture changed. And I became someone entirely different. I became someone who had the self-confidence that I always wanted to have, because I felt that self-confidence was something that brimmed all the way up to the top. Something that was not, didn't have any feelings of weakness in it, didn't have any feelings of frustration or confusion. I thought that being a man meant that you were impervious to fear, impervious to anxiety, impervious to all of those things, and you really didn't care, and it didn't make any difference. And you became a woman's pet and a man's threat. And that's what I became. That's what I felt that I was, anyway. I don't know whether I was that or not, but that's the way I became. I was, as a teenager, I I can remember being invited over to someone's house one time. And I was 15, 16 years old. I don't really remember. I think it was about 15. And I was invited over. And I was kind of wondering why I was invited, because I wasn't going with a girl at that time. I wanted to go with a girl, but I didn't have one. I didn't have a girlfriend at that time. And I knew that this was a boy-girl thing, and I was invited over there, and I went over there, and I remember knocking on the door, and the girl's father came to the door and said, "They're downstairs," and I went downstairs. I can tell you to this day, I remember what I was wearing. I mean, that's how the memory of this impressed me so much. But I walked down to the rec room. And there were downstairs, this room was pretty crowded, and there was two groups of people. On one side, all the girls were sitting over here on this wall, except there was a guy sitting over there at a table right back in the back, and he had a girl sitting on his lap, and they were picking out records to put on one of these little 45 RPM record players, which was relatively new at that time. And on the other side were all the jocks. And, you know, the leaders in high school, the ones on this side, those girls over there, you know, they were the cheerleaders, and they were the ones that were getting good grades, and they were all pretty. And here I was, and I weighed 165 pounds at that time, and I was 5'11", and I thought I was going to die from terminal acne, and I damn near did. But I didn't know why I was invited. I thought maybe they invited me so they could ridicule me or something, because I just really, there had to be a reason why they invited me, because I wasn't athletic, and, you know, I wasn't a particularly good mixer with people, and I wasn't, I was a lonely kind of a guy, and I just didn't fit in with them. You know, and I just didn't know why I was there at all. I didn't think that I was witty or charming or sing, or I couldn't dance, and obviously they were going to do that. One of the guys there, one of the jocks, asked me if I'd like to have a beer, and I said, yeah. And so we went back into the laundry room. There's a refrigerator back there, and he got out a can of beer for himself and one for me, and we opened it, and we stood there, and we drank the beer. And no big deal. I'd had a beer before. Nothing, you know, nothing untoward about it. It was an unusual circumstance for me to have a beer under those conditions. Then I had that beer, and I walked out, and I talked to a couple of the guys, and the guys seemed to want me to be there, and I talked to a couple of girls, and they didn't pinch their noses, look at me this way, or anything like that. And I went back, and I had another can of beer. And I had another can of beer, and I came out, and I don't remember what the song was that was being played at that time, but I asked one of the better-looking bosomy gals to dance with me, and she did. She was willing to dance with me, and I didn't step on her toes. As a matter of fact, she stepped on mine. And I began to get the impression of why I had been invited. I had been invited to lend a little air of sophistication to these young juveniles and to give them some wit and some charm and add something to it, because I was debonair, and I had a sophistication that they would never be able to approach. And I'll tell you something, if drinking two cans of beer does that to me, then if it did it for me now, I'd still have two cans of beer. There's no question about that. And any of you that do that or had that experience, you'll know exactly what happened to me. It was like it was like going from a cocoon, you know, that little worm, that little caterpillar in a cocoon, in the metamorphosis of a butterfly. And I was just out there, and I was there. I drank on every occasion that I possibly could thereafter, because it made me feel on the inside the way that other people looked on the outside. And I drank that way until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it always did something for me. It didn't do anything to me, it did for me. Because drinking was my solution. Drinking was a solution to my problem. drinking was never a problem to me. My drinking was a problem to a lot of people. I mean, I was arrested 23 times for public intoxication and twice for being in possession of a vehicle while drunk and once for urinating in public. And all of it alcohol related. I wasn't a flasher. I thought about it, but I didn't think that I would look good in a picture that way. So I knew I would never be arrested for indecent exposure because it would be insufficient evidence. But I never, just really wanted, that just wasn't my thing. If you're like I am, if you're an alcoholic, we all thought about doing those things. I always thought about doing all of those things. I thought about doing anything and everything. I don't think there's anything that escaped me that I didn't think about. I just didn't get around to doing them all. That's all. I was busy. If I'd had a chance, I probably would have. But I can tell you this, anything that you have done, and I've heard well over 100 fifth steps, and I can guarantee you one thing, there wasn't anything that any of those guys did that I wouldn't have done had I been in their situation. I would have done exactly and precisely the same thing. So I hardly think that we're in a position to judge one another as to what we do or what we don't do or how sick somebody is or how sick somebody isn't, because I think that we're capable of doing those things. By the way, if you feel a little bit snotty about that and think that you never would have, I have a question for you. Did you ever have a blackout? How do you know you didn't? Because I don't know. I don't know what the hell I did when I was blacked out. I think maybe blackouts were a gift to alcoholics like me, so I wouldn't know what I did, because then I would have really had to drink, wouldn't I? I remember the first time I was arrested, and I thought to myself, if my father could see me now. My grandfather had been a special assistant to the Attorney General of the United States. He had been a governor of North Carolina, as a matter of fact. And they had been involved in the legal field and in doing things and being right all of their lives. And if they could see me, what a humiliation it would have been. What a humiliation for them. And I remember thinking about that. And I remember the second time I was arrested, thinking what an inconvenience it was. And I remember the third time I was arrested, I was glad that I had a $20 bill tucked away in my wallet so I could get out in 3 hours. And that's the way it became. It just became something that was going to happen to interfere with my drinking. And it became all right. It was an inconvenience, but, it's no big deal. It wasn't any big deal. It was kind of like a bar closing. Then you'd have to go to your car and get a bottle out of the trunk. It was inconvenient, but it was always possible to drink. But so even the unacceptable becomes acceptable after a while. Absolutely. And there's no question about that. And I want to convert that now to a little thinking for you. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous was unacceptable to me. I didn't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never knew anybody that was in AA. I never knew anybody that knew anybody that was in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I knew of Alcoholics Anonymous because as a boy I was selling the Saturday Evening Post from door to door. And I read the Jack Alexander article, and it was printed in March of 1941, because I was a good salesman even then, just as a kid. And I learned that if you tell the people what's in the magazine, they're more likely to buy it. So I had to read the magazine before I would go door to door and sell this thing. And I remember reading the Jack Alexander article, and I remembered about Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I remembered about Alcoholics Anonymous was, once you enter Alcoholics Anonymous, you never drink again. It was like going into a leper colony. Once you're in, and you never get out. That was one thing I remembered. And I remembered it was alcoholics helping alcoholics somehow. And my mind told me that alcoholics, there was something about God in there. And so I knew what it was. was an organization run by a bunch of little gray-haired little old ladies with blue tint who had, as my sponsor would say, thin blue lips, who would lead us in prayer and hymns. And it was, put a nickel on the drum, save another drunken bum. You know, it was the Salvation Army, and I didn't want to go there. That was the last place I wanted to go, because I knew it was filled with bums and ne'er-do-wells and derelicts and some has-beens and some used-to-wases, and I wasn't that. Even in my saddest moments, I wasn't that. I was better than that, I thought. And so I didn't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous so good that I spent literally thousands of dollars in psychiatry. And I was going to see a psychiatrist. The last psychiatrist I saw was a little man that was in his early 60s, and he was crippled. And I always felt sorry for him because he was crippled, and he couldn't live the life that I lived. And he had false teeth, and they had magnets on them. And every now and then when he talked, they clicked together or something, made clacking noises. They came loose and floated around in his mouth. I don't know what the hell he did. But whatever it wasn't very attractive to me. And I remember this guy. I remember after going to him for months, and I went to him for a year and a half, twice a week. And I remember my last time there, I asked him, I said, "Doctor," I said, "I've been coming here for a year and a half, and I've been coming here twice a week, and I've been paying out $55, which is what the price was in those days, for each hour segment, which I only get to sit in here for 45 minutes. I never did understand. I still don't understand that. I think they just screw us because we're crazy and they can get away with it. And, I told him, I said, "You know, when I came in here," I said, "you gave me a whole bunch of tests, and you gave me the Rorschach test and all kinds of identification things like the Minneapolis multiphasic thing and, you know, so on and so forth." And I said, "You never did tell me the result of those things." And he said, "Well, it's really very simple, Dick." He said, "You seem to be preoccupied with sex." And I immediately thought I was some sort of a pervert. I was. I'll try to explain that later, too. Sometimes I forget, and I get strange people coming up and talking to me about their perversions. And I'm not sure I want to hear it. I asked him, I said, "Well, when do you think I'll have some relief from these life problems?" And he asked me how old I was, and I said, "I'm 33. And I said to myself, "My God." He answered, I told him I was 33, and he said, "It took you a long time to get here, didn't it?" And I thought, "My God, I'm going to have to come to him for 33 years. And I said, I looked at him, and he was much older than I was, and I thought, "He's going to die. What am I going to do then?" And so I asked him a third question. I said, "Doctor," I said, "should I go to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "No, you're not ready for that yet." And I said, "Well, I don't care what I am, where I am, or what you are, or what this is, but this is not being of any help to me, and I don't want you to even send me a bill because I'm not going to pay it, and this is the last time I'm coming." And I got up and I walked out. There was no negotiation. I just left. That was in about March of 1965, March or April of 1965. And March or April the previous year, I had left my wife and my two children, and I kind of figured, screw them, they can fend for themselves. I got some drinking to do, which was my attitude at the time. I didn't want to leave the kids into her hands, of course, because she was a bitch. But I love my kids, but, you know, I didn't have much choice. I couldn't take care of them, so I just left. And I did, however, have these terrible feelings of guilt about doing that. And I felt sorry for those kids because they needed a father. And I knew that they needed the support money. And strangely, and I don't even know how I did this, but I paid my child support every month on time, every penny of it. For 18 years, I did that. That's a long damn time to do anything. if you decide you're going to have kids, by the way, and get a divorce, I suggest that you not do that, you know. Because there were times in my drinking when I had to write out that drunken check, and I can guarantee you I resented the hell out of everything. Me, them, it. And that was my drinking money, and I didn't want them to take that away from me. I just wandered into a terrible, terrible time is what I did. And I regularly drank at least a fifth a day. It wasn't unusual for me to get drunk and drink two-fifths a day. And I did that for the remainder of the summer. I had been doing that all along. And something happened to me. And what happened to me is that I was out one night with a gal that I'd been having an affair with since before I had met my wife, and all during the time I was courting my wife, and all during the time I was engaged to her, and all during the time when I was married to her, and so on and so forth. It wasn't any big deal. She worked in broadcasting, and she understood me. And, I mean, we'd go to bed occasionally, but it was just kind of friendly type screwing, you know, wasn't any big romance or wasn't any kissing and hugging or anything like that, you know, just coupling in the back seat of a car, you know, no big deal. And I never thought of that as being adultery or anything like that. It just seemed like the right thing to do. The pressure was on, you know. And, but I was out having dinner with this gal. That day I had gotten an American Express card. And I still have that American Express card. It's dated 965. I've had an American Express card longer than Robert Redford has, by the way. I don't know what distinction that gives me, but I'd just gotten in the mail that day, and you know, you get a credit card, you have to amortize these things or else they're going to spoil. And, so we went out to dinner, and we had been out drinking the night before and gotten awfully drunk. And I was really burning hard coal that day. And we agreed to meet at a restaurant and have something to eat quickly and go to a movie. And, to save us from another drunken night, I guess. Because I just wasn't well enough to drink like that. And she wasn't either. And we met at this restaurant, we had a couple of martinis and looked at the newspaper and found out that the movie hadn't changed or had changed or something, and it wasn't what we wanted to see anyway. And so this was in Washington, D.C., and we got in my car and we drove out into the suburbs and out into the country, really. Went to Old Angler's Inn, which is a very fancy suburban country inn, and very expensive, and went out there and had dinner. Now, I don't remember what we had to eat. I know we had a couple of drinks before dinner, naturally, and during dinner, I know we had two bottles of wine, but I don't have any idea what we ate for dinner. The eating wasn't important, but I remember leaving there, and I drove back to where we had started out because her car was there, and we decided we were going to have a drink, have a nightcap, and at this particular restaurant, they had a sidewalk cafe, and we sat at this sidewalk cafe, and drank Remy Martin, Grand Fin Champagne Cognac, and coffee. And while I didn't always drink Remy Martin, Grand Fin Champagne Cognac, but again, I had a credit card, you know. And I wanted to look good. So we had a few drinks, and she asked me to marry her. And I thought to myself, I had a moment of clarity like I had never had before. And it wasn't that I was unwilling to marry her. But what I did was I finished that drink and got up and left. And that was the last drink I had. And that was exactly the right number of drinks. I had exactly and precisely the right number of drinks. Because if I'd have had one more drink, I'm sure we would have started negotiating. And if we'd have started negotiating, I knew she had a little money. But I didn't have any vague idea how much money she had. But her family had been involved in own patents or something, or own the multi-lift machine. And she came into net to her $27 million within 2 years of that time. And if I'd have known she was going to come into that money, I would have ended up with her. I wouldn't have ended up here, I can guarantee you. Where she ended up was she got fired from her job, and she didn't want to be fired from her job, but she got fired from her job, and she built a house down in the Virgin Islands, a huge house down there, and she ended up dying from an overdose of pills and alcohol. And I would have been right there with her. I would have died right beside her, and I'm glad that I didn't. The thoughts that came into my mind when she asked me were, I can't do that. I haven't been able to be a husband the way I view a husband should be to my wife. I haven't been a good father. I haven't been a good son. I haven't been a good brother. I'm not a good employee. I'm not a good neighbor. I'm not a good friend. I'm not a good citizen. And I just looked at her. Those thoughts all went through my head, and I said, I can't do that. That's the words that came out of my mouth. I can't do that. And I paid the bill, and I got up, and I went home. And I sat on the edge of my bed, and I thought to myself, Jesus, what's wrong with me? Why can't I be like other people? What am I going to do? God, what am I going to do? I can't live like this. I just can't keep this up. I saw myself for exactly and precisely what I was, and I didn't want to live that way anymore. And the idea came to me. I would like to say it was some big flash or something, or a bush caught on fire outside my window. But that isn't really what happened. What happened is a thought came to me and said, you've tried everything else. Why don't you try AA? And I lay down and I went to sleep. And I got up the next morning and I didn't have a drink. And I had a drink to have if I wanted one. But I didn't have a drink. And I got up and I called a minister that I'd talked to once before, who had said something. He said he was willing to take me to AA. And I called him up and I said, you know, Tom, I said, I'm drinking more and enjoying it less, and I want to go to AA. And he said, I'll put you in touch with somebody. And he put me in touch with somebody. And this man called me and asked me to meet him at the corner of Fox Hall and Reservoir Roads in Washington, D.C. And by the way, I'm a member of the Fox Hall group in Bellevue, Nebraska. There is a Fox Hall group in Washington, D.C. also, which Peggy and I started after I was sober for a little over a year. And this guy called me and wanted me to meet him there, and he did, and he picked me up. And he took me to a meeting in Silver Spring, Maryland. And this meeting he took me to was community center. It was the basement of an old stone building, and it still exists today, I believe. And I remember walking down those basement steps and thinking to myself, my God, what have I come to? What have I come to? Going down to some meeting in some grungy community building, and the steps were uneven flagstone and it wasn't well lit. And I thought, Jesus, what is this? You know, what am I come to? And I'll tell you what I came to. There was a man standing in the doorway, and that man was standing in the doorway, held out his hand, and he said, good evening. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're glad you're here. Now, I was not welcome many places. There were places that I would go that people acted like I was welcome, but I knew I wasn't welcome. But he said that, and he meant it. And I knew he did. And that was a service meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that you're expecting me to go on to say that I became delegate and a trustee and all that. I didn't. I went to a service meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they played a film strip, something like Circles of Love and Service. And it showed the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was fascinated by it because I didn't think it would work. But obviously, they told me that there were some 250,000 people in AA worldwide at that time. And if it worked for 200, I was impressed by that number, 250,000 people. I was really impressed. Worldwide membership of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. And I was really impressed by that. And I figured if it worked for 250,000 people, it would work for me. Maybe. And after that meeting was over, we went over to a hot shop and they, forced me to take these guys that went over there. Three guys went with me and I was sitting on the inside in a booth. I remember that. And, the fellow who told me he was my sponsor, told me, he says, what I want you to get is I want you to get a hot fudge ice cream cake with marshmallow on it. And I said, well, I'm not sure I can hold that down. I might throw it up. And he just looked at me. He says, it's all right. He says, they have plenty here at this place. So I got one, and I ate it. It was the first time I'd had anything like that in years. And I didn't throw it up for some reason or another. I don't know why. But he told me, he said, if you're not diabetic, are you? And I said, no. And he said, well, what it can do, he said, putting sugar in the system of a non-drinking alcoholic, what it does is it gives you a physical sense of well-being because alcohol is converted to sugar in your body. And so you're going to need a lot of sugar when you first get sober. And so I ate a lot of sugar up to 200. I went from 155 pounds then to 208 in less than 6 months. So I ate a lot of sugar. But, and they sat there in a very classic sense of the word. They made a 12-step call, and they told me about them, and they told me about their feelings. They told me about how it felt before they took a drink, and they told me what happened after they drank, and they told me the things that they had done. And I knew that they weren't putting this on. I knew that they didn't know anything about me. Because my connection to them had been entirely anonymously, and I knew that. They didn't know me, but they were telling my story, and they were telling me about me. It seemed like they knew something that I didn't know, and they did. They knew how to stay sober, and I didn't know how to stay sober. And they gave me that gift of one alcoholic talking to another. They gave me that gift of identification that night. And that's what happened. I've talked to you about what it was like and what happened. I want to talk to you a little bit about what it's like now. I became very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a meeting every night for at least a year and stayed very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started sponsoring people right away. One of the people that I started sponsoring people before I was sober for 3 months. And I know you're not supposed to do that, but I did it anyway. And one of those guys that I did that with is still sober today. I talked to him not 2 months ago. He's still a sober, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how the hell he stayed sober because I didn't know enough to help him, but it worked just the same. But what I did was I did what Bill Wilson said. I took him to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to be 12-step. That's exactly and precisely what I did. And I was a friend to him. I befriended him. I helped him. And I helped to guide and direct his actions as best I could with guidance and direction from my sponsor. And Ted is still sober today. And I'm still sober today. I didn't do it to keep me sober, by the way. And I didn't do it to help Ted. I did it for another reason entirely. I did it because the sober, active members of Alcoholics Anonymous around me that I respected went on 12-step calls. The sober, active, respective members of Alcoholics Anonymous were sponsoring people. And they seemed to be happy in their lives. And so I did what they did. It was a program of attraction to me, and I was attracted to these people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I did it so I could be identified as being one of them. I thought maybe if I was identified as one of those people, maybe I could be like they were. And they were sober, and I wanted to be sober. I had then developed a desire to stop drinking. I didn't have that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it developed. I developed a desire to stop drinking. This fellow who sponsored me is dead now, and he was a great help to me. He saved my life. He literally saved my life because he was there. He was always there for me, and he was always, he poked fun at me is what he did. He made me see and made me able to laugh at myself and to see my own frailties that I couldn't see. I could see things like that I perceived to be weaknesses in me. And he said, no, that's a strength. And he was able to turn me around so that I could see life differently. And he taught me to live the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he taught me that I should learn about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I should be active in AA, but most of all, what I should do is to help others. Contrary to what I seem to hear from the professionals today, and the professionals seem to say that Alcoholics Anonymous is a self-help program, he taught me that Alcoholics Anonymous is a help others program. And that's exactly and precisely what I know it to be. I don't come here anymore to help myself. I get help by coming here. I want to come here because I enjoy coming here. I enjoy being here. I enjoy being in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I enjoy being at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't do it because I have to do it. I didn't do it then because I had to do it. I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I chose to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any other place to go, but when I went through the other choices, there only remained one choice, and that was AA. I felt that my case was different when I came into AA because I felt that I was bright and competent and well thought of, or I could be if I stayed sober. And I thought, God, but I'm got this burden of this wife and I'm paying alimony to and these two children. There isn't anyone going to have anything to do with me. And I went to a meeting at the Friendship Group in Washington, D.C., and the secretary there was a little gal that giggled and laughed a lot, and she kept dropping the notes and losing them on the floor, and I thought she needed a keeper. And I pursued her with the ardor of a newcomer, and she succumbed to my wily ways, and I've been married to her ever since. We got married not long after that, and we've been married for over 26 years. Some of you, it isn't our fault. I mean, it really isn't. It's really by God's grace that we're married today. And it isn't that I'm a bad actor or she's a bad actor. It's that we're both human beings. And we both have our frailties, and we're not perfect people. And, you know, we have to give each other our space and our time, and she has to do her thing, and I have to do my thing, and she has to allow me to do mine, and I allow her to do hers. And we have the freedom of doing that as long as it doesn't, long as what she does or what I do doesn't interfere with our relationship. And I say interfere with our relationship, I mean that it doesn't break up the ideas and the ideals that we had talked about and we had agreed upon that what a marriage should and should not be between us. I'm not going to stand here and say what your marriage should be, but I know what ours should be because we talked about it a lot. And we talked about it a lot, although we only dated for 2 months. We talked about it a lot before we got married. We talked it to death before we got married, as a matter of fact, because I had made a terrible mistake in getting married before. I married someone that I didn't love, and I didn't want to do that again, and I desperately loved her. And I think that she desperately loved me, not because I was so great, and I didn't love her because she was so great, but we were two lonely alcoholics who just needed somebody to love. And we found each other. We were very fortunate. Have a son who's a 3.5-year member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who was married to a gal that's been sober for 7 years, soon coming up on 8. He made the drastic error of marrying someone who'd been sober longer than he has. Taking it like father, like son. I kept telling me, ought not to do that. And I said, she's a fine gal, and she is a fine gal. If I'd have gone out and tried to find my son a wife, I wouldn't have been able to find anybody any better than Maya. And I mean that. And I just love her to death. She's a little sweetheart, isn't she? She really is. I also have a daughter by that first marriage. And that daughter will be sober 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. On the 11th of December. And she'd come to live with us until she graduated from high school. And said that she couldn't live with the rules in our house of things like not drinking and smoking pot and staying out all night with Sally, whose name was John. And I just told her that that behavior wasn't acceptable, and she was welcome to stay, but if she insisted on doing that, she was going to have to leave, and she left. And she left and moved in with Sally, whose name was John. And they left the area and moved down to Florida, and finally got married, and ended up getting a divorce. And I suspect, although I've never heard her say it, because of her alcoholism, because ultimately she was forced into Alcoholics Anonymous, and she took to it like a duck to water. And she's done very well, and she's sober. I talk to her frequently now. I saw her a couple of years ago. And she had been sober 6 months. She'll be sober 3 years, won't she? Yeah. I saw her a couple of years ago, anyway, in June. And I went to attend a wedding. My son, by that marriage, had gotten married. I went to the wedding, and I saw Nancy there. And Nancy came into the hotel, and I kind of waited for her. She came into the hotel. She said hello. I said hello to her. She said, well, I guess you've heard I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous now. I said, good for you. That's all I said. She said, well, I have to go up and get dressed. She went up and got dressed. And that was the first time I'd seen her in 12 years. And she came downstairs later, and we went to the wedding and attended the wedding ceremony, and after the ceremony was over, we had a reception, and Peg wasn't with me. I sat at the family table. My ex-wife sat here, and my daughter was sitting here, and her boyfriend was over there. And all of a sudden, my daughter Nancy, all she wanted to do was to talk about AA. And I asked my ex-wife if she would move so we could go sit there and I could talk to Nancy. So we sat there and we talked about Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, and all of a sudden it just dawned on me that I had to do something, and I said, Nancy, come with me. And she came with me, and we went out into the hall. I said, you know, during the time when you were growing up, when you lived with us, I did a lot of things that were wrong, and I know that they were wrong, and I apologize for those, and I'll do anything I can to amend the situation, because I don't want our relationship to be like this. I would like to be thought of as a father, as your father. And all this time she kept interrupting me and saying, well, I was reacting and, you know, all this crap. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I've been sober for 25 years. You've been sober for 6 months. You let the old timer make his amends first. And then you can make your amends. And she laughed. And we got along well, and we talk on the phone frequently. She lives in Maryland, and I live in Nebraska. And she's happy where she is, and I'm happy where I am, and she's doing well. And I have as good a relationship with her as I should have today. And it's perfectly satisfactory to me, because it's 1,000 times better than it was. And so it takes a long time. It's not that it takes a long time to make amends. It takes a long time to find the correct time to make the proper amend. So if you're here and you still have amends to make to people, make those amends when the proper time comes.
because then you'll feel relieved and you won't feel that pain anymore and it'll be okay. That's the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, to amend our lives, to change our lives, not to suit them, but to change them so that we feel the Spirit of God within us. I was sober about 10 years, and I was living in Bellevue, Nebraska, and my first sponsor was living in Washington, D.C., and he and I by this time had become good friends. And I'd call him up and chat with him every now and then, and he'd tell me who died or who got drunk or whatever it was. And he just wasn't really a sponsor, to tell you the truth. He was no longer my sponsor. He was just a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I enjoyed him, and I enjoyed talking to him, but I just didn't have a sponsor anymore, and I was very active in AA at that time, and I was beginning to pick up a lot of guys out there in Nebraska to sponsor him. I began to feel strange and distorted about this, being a sponsor and not really having a sponsor, and I knew this, but it was like reaching out in the dark and knowing that there was something out there, but it was just beyond my grasp, and I didn't know what the hell was wrong. And what was wrong was the fact that I didn't have a sponsor, and it took me several years to come to the conclusion that I really ought to do something about this and to get a sponsor. Someone that I knew was my sponsor, not someone that I called sponsor. Someone that in fact was my sponsor because I agreed to that, because I had to surrender to the term of sponsorship. Not surrender to another human being, because that isn't the attitude at all. But surrender to the principle of sponsorship. Just like I surrendered to the principle of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous by fully conceding to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I had to concede to sponsorship that I had chosen a person, a human being, to put his intellect over my emotions when it came to decision-making time. And I couldn't have made a better choice. I couldn't have made a better choice for me. I had met a fellow at a conference in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, August of 1978. And Bob, as a matter of fact, has a set of tapes back there. There's two talks by this fellow whom he made at that conference. And that talk that he made turned my life around. He talked about alcoholism, and he talked about life in AA, and he talked about life sober and life drunk that I identified with thoroughly. And I identified with it thoroughly from the very first meeting, and I laughed, and it changed my life. And I ultimately ended up staying active in Alcoholics Anonymous because of him. So I decided I would probably be better off if I would ask this man to sponsor me. And I'd been asked to speak out in California and Sacramento, and I went up, and I caught a plane, I called him up, and I said, I want to come down to Los Angeles and see you. And he said, I had somebody meet you at the airport, and he did, and he picked me up and took me into the midnight mission. And I had a conversation with the man I know as sponsor today, but you know as Clancy Emerson. And I had a conversation, I said, Clancy, I need a sponsor. And I said, I would like for you to please sponsor me. On the way down in that plane, I knew I was going to do this. And I thought to myself, but Clancy doesn't sponsor people that have mustaches or beards. And I said, I don't really give a damn whether he does or not. If he wants me to shave my mustache off, I'll shave it off. If he wants me to shave my head, I'll shave my head. I just want him to sponsor me. Because he was the action-oriented AA member that I knew him to be. And I wanted that. And I needed his help and his direction. I needed some discipline in my life. And I need more structure in my life than I had. And so I asked him to sponsor me. And he and I were friends up to that point. And he said, I would be glad to sponsor you, but I'm no longer your friend. And I said, the hell you're not. And he said, you do understand, don't you? And I said, yes, I understand. And it's been like that ever since. I'm going to give you one instance, just one small thing that happened this year, and then I'm going to stop. I have gotten along very well in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had a relatively successful life. After I had 27 years in broadcasting, I started another business, and it's running along very successfully. My wife is a part of that, and part of that success. And I've enjoyed that. And I've been very active sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor many, many guys, and my time is hardly my own. And I've been very active in a lot of people's lives on a very personal level and a very private level. And they've been very active in my life on a very personal and a very private level as a result of that, as a result of being a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And somehow or another, when I'm doing those things and listening to them, I'm not listening to me. And, you know, that might not seem like much to you, but, you know, I'll be very honest with you. You know, I may not be much sometimes, but I'm all I think about sometimes. I can tell you that. And I don't need to do that. And they keep me busy and they keep me out of myself. Some 6 or 7 months ago, I was having the beginnings of some problems, some physical problems that are shortly going to be resolved with no problem, with no concern to me at this point. But I was beginning to be concerned about this. And frankly, what happened was I was beginning to get depressed. And I couldn't put my finger on it. I couldn't say that this is the reason why this is, but I had just lost all my fire. I'd lost all my spirit. And I just didn't care. You know, I just didn't care. I was, whatever. And I didn't like feeling that way. Peggy would send me get well cards, for Christ's sake. I just wanted to hit her. And it really got pretty bad. It really got pretty bad for me. And I talked to Clancy about this. And he said, well, how old are you, Dick? And I said, I'm 60. And he said, when were you 60? And I said, last December. And he said, well, he says, let me tell you about that. He says, at the age of 50 for women and at the age of 60 for men, it's the watershed year. And at that period of time, he said, people think it's all over. And he said, Dick, he says, I don't want you to think it's all over, but it is. And ever since then, I've been better. Beats the shit out of me. I called him up the next week, and I said, you know, I'm feeling better, and everything is good. And I said, I don't know what the hell's the matter, but I haven't slipped my wrist or committed suicide. And he said, all the evidence isn't in yet, Dick. He's able to allow me the dignity of laughing at myself is what it really amounts to. He allows me the dignity to be me and to see my own failings. He doesn't point my failings out to me. But he allows me to see my own failings, and he allows me the dignity of laughing at my own failings. And I love him. I love what he has done for me. I'm not the ordinary sort of a guy that came into Alcoholics Anonymous without a past. I came in here with a past that I've had to live with just like you have, like many of you have. There wasn't hardly anything that I can think of that I didn't do before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not one of the namby-pamby sit-around types. I was into action, and I got into a lot of fights and brawls and bars and nearby alleys and that sort of thing. These things would drive me crazy because I know that I injured someone very badly one time, and I left them there. And whether they died or not, I don't know positively, but I think so. And it's kind of hard to live your life thinking that what you have done is quite probably taken someone else's life. And I didn't do it on purpose. It was just in a drunken rage. And it's kind of hard to live with that sort of thing. It's kind of hard to live with the thought that I'm a man that has feelings, and I'm a man of dignity, and I'm a man of grace, and I recognize the grace of God, and I recognize what the recognition that others have towards me, and I think of myself as being better than that. And it's difficult sometimes. It has been hard for me to live with the thoughts of this man, this East Indian that I got in a drunken brawl with in London when I was in the service years ago. And I've never talked about this, but I've thought about him, and I've thought about the fact that I probably did kill him, and I thought about that. And it's not easy to live with something like that. It's not easy to live with something like that when you know that that isn't what you want to do in life. It isn't easy to live with thoughts that I've done something that I would abhor in others. And so I can't abhor anything in others. It's really kind of strange. It really changed my life so that I can't abhor anything in others. And I think that's why I have the capability of being a good sponsor, because I don't feel the same way about them that some other people would. And I really got some sick people, I'll tell you. And I'm glad of that. I'm glad of that because I've been able to be helpful. And I believe that God has put me in a unique position. And that unique position that He has put me in was the fact that I recognized the fact that I was an alcoholic, and I've been able to do something about it. And I've been able to make some form of recovery through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been able to help others. That I've been able to give someone else possibly the guidance so that they could save their own life and so that they could recognize the grace of God. And I feel good about life. I feel good. I feel safe. I feel secure. I feel firm in the conviction that if I were to die right now, that I'm at least even with the board, if not a little bit ahead. And that's hard to say. That doesn't sound very humble, perhaps, but it's truthful. That's the way I feel. And that's all because of the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you. Thank you very much.